Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining me today to answer your gardening questions are two folks you may already know and two new guests. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York, where they're having their spring plant sale May 18th and 19th. Also joining us today for the first time is Bob Graves, co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Bob is a horticulturist and avid hands-in-the-dirt gardener for 40 years. Also new to the panel is gardener Kerry Ann Mendez, director of marketing for Fadigan's Nursery. Kerry is a garden consultant, writer, teacher, and lecturer focusing on time-saving gardening techniques, workhouse, workhorse plant material. All right, we'll find out about that in a moment, and organic practices. And we welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also reach us by going to our WAMC Vox Pop page. It's wamc.org/VoxPop. You'll find lots of interesting information, including all the contact info for our guests today. And you can comment at the bottom of the page, and Patrick Donges will race in here breathlessly and read the comments, and it'll be great. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Again, the number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Fred, Greg, Kerry, Bob, welcome all. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, let's dispense with this now. What's a workhorse plant material, Kerry?
Something that ideally you don't have to pamper. I mean, that's, yes, it needs water and the right light, and but it's a plant that is going to make you look good with not a lot of hand-holding on your part.
That's good. That's very good. Well, the lines are already picking up here, so let's go right to the phones and get as many calls in as we can. We'll start with Lori in Saugerties. Lori, you're on.
Hi, thank you very much. It's nice to get in first. So I have a question that I think affects a lot of people. I have a lot of grapevine in my garden and growing up my trees, and I'm wondering how to get rid of this invasive plant in the least toxic way possible.
You know, a great way to get rid of almost any woody unwanted plant is through cutting. The way plants work is they're going to use stored energy, and they'll leaf out in the spring through stored energy, and then once those leaves are out, they're counting on those leaves to photosynthesis and create energy and continue the whole life cycle. So the goal is to sort of, the key with cutting them is timing. If you cut at the wrong time, you can get even more growth. So let them flush out in the spring, come in, literally cut them right at the base, and then watch it. You may get another sprout or two of suckers appearing from that rootstock. If you do, cut it again. The goal is let them use all the stored energy to flush out, then cut them. They can't photosynthesize. There's no more energy. If they sprout again, cut them. There's no more energy, and you'll win. No herbicide needed.
All right, that's Fred Breglia. And Greg, it looks like you wanted to say something as well.
Oh, sure. First of all, grapes are not considered invasive. They are they can work in the landscape, but pruning the base of them, as Fred said, is going to be the best solution. And doing it right about now, they're starting to break bud, so we're getting close to that time.
Bob, Kerry, anybody want to jump in?
No, I agree. The effort, you're basically trying to starve them to death, to keep trimming them and cutting them, and it may take some time, but you just keep after them, unless you're going to use herbicides, but you can do it without.
Okay.
Great, thanks very much.
Lori,
I appreciate it.
Thanks for being first. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Gardening today, and we go to Amanda in Albany. Hi, Amanda.
Hi there. I have a question for the fellow gardeners. I'm a second-year gardener. I'm very excited. And last year, my garden didn't do so well. So this year, when I was out there in the fall, I noticed that I had a lot of pine needles falling into my garden from a large pine tree that overhangs. And I was wondering, I've talked to a bunch of people, and they say adding lime to my soil would help balance my pH. Is that true?
Well, thank you. You never assume anything when it comes to pH. You want to have a pH test done. Sometimes it comes out to be acidic in that situation, but I've seen the opposite. I've seen it be alkaline. I honestly see a lot of people with alkalinity problems where the pH is relatively high, where they've added compost that was alkaline, or it's been limed too much, or lots of times when you water, continuously with municipal water, the pH of municipal water is high. So you may need to change that pH, but you got to have it checked to know. You cannot assume.
And, okay. And where's in the Albany area, where's the best place to do that?
If around this area, we do it at Fadigan's, or you can take it to the Cooperative Extension Office in your county. In Albany, it's in Voorheesville, Schenectady downtown, and in Troy, and Rensselaer County in Troy.
So what do you, just bring a bucket full of dirt and say, here, check it out, man?
not
exactly. But it's a good question, Ray, because the soil test is only as good as the sample that you give them.
Yeah.
And the best way to get a really good sample is to actually test multiple areas of the garden or the area that you want to know the pH on. If it's your entire property, multiple different random tests.
Okay.
And I also encourage people to take random soil samples from different depths as well. So a little bit under the surface, maybe down 6 inches. If you're growing trees, you want to go down, 12, 15 inches because roots will get that deep. But mix them all together and make a really good representative sample.
Oh, you don't want to have... You don't want to take, say, mark it and say, hey, this is from the back corner of the lot. This is, you want to just jumble it all together?
You want to get multiple different areas of the garden. So if it's an area that's, 10 by 10 garden, you're going to want to test many different areas and many different depths, mix them together, give a really good representative sample.
But if you're doing your backyard and your front yard, you may want to keep those.
You might keep it separate that way.
All right. Hey, Amanda, how does that do you?
That sounds great. You guys think I should rototill before I take the sample? Or
is it a vegetable garden?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot of research right now showing a lot of advantages to not rototilling at all.
So don't rototill. It's not a huge garden.
Yeah, I wish they told me and my dad that 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But my wife and I have been doing it, and I could spend quite a bit of time into all the exact reasons why this is good, but I won't do that because we don't have a lot of time. But what I will say is this. My wife and I have been doing organic gardening at our house with the no-till method, and we have had way less weeds. We've had significantly better plant growth and, of course, certainly a much better feeling back at the end of the day.
That's good.
The way you do it is you smother the grass, though. That's the key. Get something down now to smother that grass for at least a month before you're going to plant it. And all the weeds will naturally die. Any of the roots that are there will break down, give you great organics for all your garden plants. And it will keep all the soil infrastructure in perfect place. And I'll leave it at that. If you want to talk more about that particular topic, I would love to. These guests are holding me down.
Yes, indeed. We're weighing you down.
Yeah. Weighing me down.
Amanda, thanks for the call. We appreciate it very much. Let's get one more call in before the first break. Sherry in Montgomery. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I want to turn off my Bluetooth here.
That's a good idea.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I wanted to know. I have a really hard pan kind of situation around my apartment house. You know, when they built it, they didn't do anything. I dug around and got some soil in the area, but I wanted to just have something that can grow anywhere. So I went out in the woods and got plants that I could see what they're going to look like, and so I could the root ball, and I planted those in this really no good soil place. Do I have any kind of an expectation of results from doing that?
Okay.
Well, I think I got it. The soil quality around her house or apartment is not very good. I believe she said hard pan, which may mean clay.
Sounds like subsoil.
And that she's planting in it anyway.
Okay.
And so I think probably we would all advise that she amend that soil before she plants in it.
All right. How do you amend the soil?
Generally speaking, that is adding compost to the existing soil.
Okay.
Initially, rototilling works very well to break that up and to add that compost, especially the first time around. Very good way to do it, yes. And so amending the soil by adding, what is a kind of a guesstimate of a 20-25% compost existing soil ratio, and you could do that soil test first to just see what else is missing. But if it's ornamentals, usually the compost, some kind of general purpose fertilizer, mulching afterwards, and things work out pretty well.
All right, Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. Anybody else want to weigh in before we go to the break on that one?
I would say that if she's looking at planting trees, then digging a hole in really hard compacted soil and adding compost creates a major problem for the long-term health of that plant. It creates an in-ground pot with roots that will tend to spiral in that hole and not want to go out of the hole. So that I agree with everything that everyone said. as long as we're not talking trees long-term in our landscape. If that's the case, then we're really looking at what kind of plant will grow in that really hard soil. It'd be better to find something that likes that. There are lots of trees that prefer really hard, rocky soil.
It's Vox Pop, the gardening show. That's Fred Breglia. Greg Ward is here. Bob Graves and Carrie-Anne Mendez. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, providing spring plants, flowers, and landscaping tools and products. Open Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. till 4:30 p.m., Sunday, 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. A gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. Mango Tree Imports, Ballston Spa, New York, a locally owned fair trade retail store featuring spring accessories and home accent pieces, open 7 days a week, first Fridays until 9 p.m., mangotreeimports.com. The 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, a newly renovated boutique hotel in the Hudson Valley, 12 guest rooms with modern amenities, gift certificates available for Mother's Day. The1850house.com. Susan Odell Taylor School, Troy, New York, preschool through sixth grade, educating children in the Capital Region since 1998. School day tours available, nurturing minds, shaping the future, taylorschool.org. And Spot Coffee, Saratoga Springs, New York, a community-oriented cafe featuring fresh roasted coffee, baked goods, soups, salad, pizza, and more, spotcoffee.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, The Gardening Show. Greg Ward, Fred Breglia, Bob Graves, and Carrie-Anne Mendez are with us. And also, at this time of the show, we'd like to welcome our producer, Patrick Donges, who has a few questions from social media. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Ray. Hi, folks. So we have Bailey on Facebook asks, where is a good place locally that I can find organic and or heirloom varieties of seedlings?
Okay. Paddle?
Well, certainly we would have some organics and some heirlooms at Fadigan's, and I assume most good garden centers in the area would. Greg, I'm sure you do.
We sure do, yeah. So if the locally is Great Barrington, I think we got that covered.
All right, fair enough.
All right, we got most of the listening area covered there. And now Joe, via email at voxpop@wamc.org, asks, I have a mature fruiting fig tree that has been surviving winters unprotected in North New Jersey. The tree has some sentimental value. The property is being sold soon. The buyer has agreed the tree may be removed and has offered his machinery to aid in the digging. It has branched into three distinct quote-unquote trees, complicating matters, and this appears to be the wrong time of year to attempt a successful transplant. Is that so, that it's the wrong type of year, and could you provide some transplanting advice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we actually sell fig trees, but we keep them in containers in the Berkshires. They just can't survive outdoors on their own. I do know of some people who have planted them outdoors and then put them in some kind of protected cover, almost built boxes over them, or they've put them outside for the summer and then back inside for the winter. Either of those things work pretty well. I think it's true that if you're in North New Jersey, the tree's probably leafed out, and moving it now is not a good idea. And so that is true. You could try it anyway on a cool, cloudy, water the tree really well and try to get it up out of the ground. If it's really big, putting it in some large container is your option to move it. So, or to keep it. I guess maybe you could plant it in another house in the same general area, and that was something you could try.
Okay. But we'd encourage you to try to move that when it was dormant as opposed to now in leaf if you wanted to try to keep it. So maybe they could talk to the owner and have them maybe do a little root pruning, which would be going around a root zone with a spade just to shear off some roots so that you condense those roots closer to the stem. And that way you do that this time of year while it is in leaf. You don't dig it out. You just go around with a spade and kind of make a circle around a tree in the ground, cutting the roots, leaving everything alone, come back in the fall, and then move it. That would be you'd have a much better chance at getting that to live.
Bob?
I agree. Absolutely.
Carrie?
Yep.
Wow. Feel free to disagree with these two. They're here all the time, and, I've been waiting for somebody to just... All right.
It's only been 15 minutes. Give us a half an hour, I'm
Patrick,
sure.
You got anything else for us?
That's it, Ray. Thank you very much.
Thanks to our producer, Patrick Donges. Back to the phones we go at 1-800-348-2551. Amy in Queensbury, you're up.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I have a quick question. Could you recommend a low-maintenance, full-sun flowering shrub?
I think we should all go around and just give our own favorites.
Yeah. Okay.
All
right, well, Carrie, why don't you go?
Carrie goes first. Carrie.
You know, I've really liked, I've been growing them for a couple of years now, the new repeat blooming lilacs, the bloomerang. I've had it now 3 years in my gardens, and it blooms spring, summer, and fall, full sun, quite drought tolerant, deer resistant, and it gives you that fragrant purple flower, nice and compact, 4 to 5 feet. So that's what I vote for. Okay. I love lilacs.
All right.
You know, it's tough to beat the new shrub roses, some of the knockout types and some of the other really, really hardy shrub roses. We've had them at the nursery for years in difficult situations, full sun, exposed. You treat them like a shrub, just trim them. You don't have to cut them back real hard, just trim them to shape, and they bloom all summer. There are not a lot of things that do that. Years ago, Potentilla was one of the few, some of the spireas, but the shrub roses are spectacular for that.
Shrub rose?
Yeah, knockout is one variety, but there's multiple varieties. But shrub roses are great.
All right.
Okay.
Greg?
I would digress a little bit. I have a I did bring in a sample of a spirea that is a spring bloomer, but it has a very chartreuse yellowy foliage. It's called Mellow Yellow.
Where is that? I don't see that one.
I'm sorry. I'm just.
Look at that. Right there. I'll be darned.
Right for you. I brought that in.
Lovely.
Anyway, right now it's in bloom. So it does give a very nice, pleasant spring bloom in a couple of weeks. And then the foliage is, as I said before, very interesting, very striking, very easy to maintain in the garden. So it's not blooming exactly, but it's giving you great color all summer long.
All right.
Yep. And I would pick an old variety that I just always seem to be one of my favorites. It's called Slender Deutzia, or Deutzia gracilis. And awesome plant. Gets to be about 3 foot tall, 3 foot wide. Never needs any pruning. I guess you'd call that a... Is it a workhorse plant?
Yeah.
All right.
Workhorse plant.
That's an early summer bloomer, but it's awesome. An older variety that's completely underutilized and should be used more. Deutzia gracilis.
Can you spell that?
That's a D-E-U-T-Z-I-A. Don't hold against me if I'm wrong. Deutzia. Slender Deutzia is the common name. Slender Deutzia. It has a very slender leaf. And the Latin name is Deutzia gracilis, which I think it's graceful. Hence gracilis.
Oh, very lovely. Amy, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. It's The Gardening Show on WAMC Vox Pop. We go to Joanne in Enfield, Connecticut. Hi, Joanne.
Oh, good afternoon. I have a question about daffodils that I've been planting for the last couple of years. We moved to this present location 4 years ago. And I made the mistake of putting daffodils where I wanted daffodils to be, and they're not getting enough sun. I'm getting greens and not even a flower stalk, nothing. So my question is, will it damage the bulb at all if I dig them up now? Because in the fall when you're supposed to be planting daffodils, the greens are gone. I have no idea where they were.
I would dig them right up. I would try to maintain that mass. If you put several together, I'm assuming there's sort of a clump there. I would try to maintain that, and that's not too difficult. But I would dig them right up, pop them in the wheelbarrow, bring them over to the next spot, dig that hole, and pop them back in.
Okay. Now here's the other thing. I thought I was planting them. The hole is supposed to be 3 times the depth of the bulb height. Is that right?
Generally, we say put 4 to 6 inches of soil above the bulb when that's in the fall. So,
all right, because I thought maybe I was planting them too deep.
It's possible, but you will be able to determine that when you take them up. You'll be able to sort of measure that depth.
Yeah, because I thought I was doing them like 3 times the height of the bulb, but I dug up 2 small ones that were all in the front yard, which were also not getting enough sun. And I just kept digging and digging and digging and digging, and they had worked. We have very sandy soil. They had worked their way down to like 8 or 9 inches deep.
You got to pick those up.
Yeah.
Okay. What was that, Bob?
You need to pick them up. They're too deep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Replant them as Greg said. Pick them up. Replant them. Get them where there's some sun.
Yeah. And, I know I didn't put them that deep. I know. I know I wasn't enthused enough when I was planting them
to do that.
Nope. Sometimes what happens with...
They work their way down.
Yeah, well, what happens, and that actually brings up a point that is, I guess, worth making, is that a lot of times people will dig a hole, and you'll overdig the hole. You're loosening the soil below the bottom of the hole. In other words, you're going to end up loosening it up, and then you end up filling it back in, and then you put your bulb in. But if once you've loosened that soil, that's going to settle. And it's even more dramatic with trees and shrubs, of course, but that will happen with bulbs. And that's my best guess as to how it got deep.
Okay.
I would just say quickly that you definitely don't want to cut the greens before they've finished yellowing. You definitely want to plant them in a sunny location. And we all would, I think, agree that you want to add some granular fertilizer to the planting area now as well as in the fall. And all of those are the things that will help bring those flowers back.
So even after it's covered with dirt, because I know you put the stuff in the bottom of the hole, and then you put the bulb in.
In this case, put it on top if you want.
But now you put it on on top of the dirt, and the bulb can still get it?
Sure.
It'll definitely make its way down.
It's got no place to go but down.
All right. Joanne, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Scott in Albany. Scott, you're on.
Hi. So I'm calling about last year. We usually get a little bit of cabbage looper in our garden. And last year, I guess, cabbage loopers are a little green guys that we always find. But last year we had some things, and we looked them up. They're a little bit different, a little bit browner. And they look like army cutworms. And we tried everything, spinosad, BT, and we couldn't get rid of them. And my only concern is we mulched our garden, and this spring when we were kind of digging through, we saw them underneath the leaves. So is this a new thing we should be concerned about, or?
Did you say they were cutworms? Were they actually sort of chopping down the new plants, or were they eating the foliage?
Well, we found some cutworms, and then others were eating the foliage just like a cabbage looper would, I guess. But they were a little bit browner in color, a little bit bigger.
So if they, cabbage looper is a moth, so that's a little caterpillar. And you could also control that with BT. And if this brown thing is a moth, and you'd kind of have to look at it again and see what it looks like. Does it have a soft head or a hard head, little shell of a head or not? If it's a moth, you could also use BT. Spinosad is supposed to work on those guys as well, though. So, and I don't know how many plants you have or acres, but picking cabbage looper works really well, simply going through, every couple of days, and they're the same color as the leaf, so it's a little tricky, but just sort of collecting them, pulling them right off there. And so if you can do that as well for these brown guys, I think you might have it licked.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if the spinosad or the BT didn't take care of that. Now, if you have cutworms, one of the time-honored ways to take care of that is to put a little collar around the plant of tar paper, or use a can or something of that sort when you're planting.
I didn't hear that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's the only way to do it. Okay. Scott, thanks a lot.
I just wanted to make sure real quick. So it's not some weird thing coming up from the south, like an army worm that can't be controlled?
Oh, they can be controlled.
I'm sure it can be controlled. It's just we're still not sure that it is, an army worm, or what an army worm is, maybe.
Okay. So we don't know what an army worm is? Thanks, Scott. So what is an army worm? We don't know?
We're from the north, right?
Okay. All right.
I know what a fire ant is.
Okay.
And it doesn't live around here, thank God.
I remember those cabbage beetles last year. What were they, the little green bugs that were on our, no, they weren't cabbage.
Stink bugs are sort of kind of moving around a little bit more. That's a new one. I've seen during certain weather patterns when we get a lot of like hurricane weather patterns at the right time, I think it's July, August, we'll get this thing called bagworm, which tends to affect especially arborvitae eastern white cedar. But so far, no other new insect that we know of.
I like Fred's method now to control the bugs that we had. He recommended just putting them in the blender and mulching them up and then painting them on the leaves of the plants, which just disgusted me for months and months and months. And it scarred
me. This is a year later. So.
Let's go to JD in Springfield. JD, you're on.
Hi, you guys are wonderful. I'm so happy to catch you today. Thank you much.
And you're welcome.
Coat them with chocolate. Eat them.
Yeah, I go a vodka route, but.
Okay. I have friends that advocate. My question is regarding a houseplant that I have. It was kind of a family heirloom. It was an ancient Christmas cactus, and it has three stalks that are really woody that stick out for about 16 to 18 inches before it gets any green stuff on it. And it's been really good about blooming, but the blooms are like way out there. So I was trying to figure out whether or not there's a safe way that I might prune it and kind of like make it come back closer together. Because by the time it gets its blossoms, it's like almost
you know, like two to three feet out.
Yeah, Christmas cactus are often passed down from generation to generation, but they do get big and old and woody, and don't be afraid to whack that right back. You can you can cut that back. It'll bring tears to your eyes.
Yeah.
But you can really cut it back, and it will recover very... Yeah, just cut it back and allow it to push out some new growth. Now, sometimes they need to be repotted, and the mistake that most people make when they repot those is that they put them in too big a pot. So if you're going to, if you need to repot it, put it into something a little bit bigger, but not too much. But sometimes that'll help them to regenerate some new growth, too.
Okay, well, how long do I lop it off from where the surface of the soil to the lop location?
I was actually just going to say that those pieces that you cut off, you could root. So and so if you want to put those in a little soilless mix, I think you could probably even root them in water if you wanted to try that. There is a little thing you can get that's called rooting hormone that would make it much more efficient to do. And then you'll have lots of little plants that you can give to your offspring.
Oh, I like it. Cheap holiday giving. That's
well,
good.
How far out from the...
You can go right back to within inches of the pot.
Oh, okay. Yep. That's what I wanted to know. Okay, thank you much. Really enjoy the show. I've been listening for years. This is the first time we've had a legit question.
Well, come on back next time. Thanks a lot. Let's go to, oops, I hit the wrong button there, Colleen. Let's go to Ann in Del Mar. No, it's I. Well, who the heck is this? Robert in Valencia. Robert, you're on.
Hello there.
Hello. Hello. I hit the wrong button, but now you're lucky and you're on.
Well thank you for getting it right. I heat my house with a wood stove, and I scatter wood ashes all over the property indiscriminately, flower beds, bulbs, into the compost heap. And I'd like to know what you think about that. Should I be careful about location, quantity? And what is the pH of wood ashes?
Well, I will say this. The wood ash is good in small doses. Wood ash is very alkaline and is very powerful alkalizer, in fact, more so than lime in most cases. So a little bit of wood ash is great in a lot of cases, but a lot of wood ash can create problems, not so much probably for a lawn, but more so for garden and trees and shrubs. And as Bob had said earlier in a program, the key is check your soil pH, because if you don't need it and you're adjusting it or your garden, you know, we don't want to haphazardly adjust pH. And that is definitely something that is going to occur, whether you want it to or not. Yeah. That lime will that
you're going to produce way more wood ash than you're ever going to want to use.
Ever going to use.
Yeah.
Well, I've got 2 acres and, you know,
yeah, it still goes a long way.
No
yeah.
kidding. But yeah. Do you know what the numerical equivalent is?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Getting back to earlier, Bob mentioned, you know, getting a soil test, a pH test. So if you can do that and understand what your pH is, it would sort of go a ways to telling you how much wood ash you could use or whether it's not a bad idea to put a little on there. If your soil is generally acidic, then the wood ash will bring that back up. It's going to be soluble. It will be, you know, sort of an annual event, and you may be able to disperse a little bit every year. And
sure, I appreciate that very much. But I do need some kind of numerical equivalent for wood ash.
A pH equivalent?
Yeah.
So I can make a judgment about how much.
You can't make a judgment until you know your pH.
Well, yeah, but I mean, on the bag of lime, you know, they tell you how much per square foot, you know.
So he's saying, what's the pH of wood ash?
There must be a numerical value for wood ash.
There may be, but if you read the bag of lime, it tells you how much lime you put down per square foot to raise the pH a certain number, but you don't know your pH yet.
I think you'd have to Google that to see if you could come up with a figure.
I would check online. I would check online because I've got to think that exists.
I'll tell you what, Robert. Sure. Why don't you call back next show in a month and let us know what it is? Yeah. You've stumped the panel.
You want me to do some work, huh?
Well, you know, they're not getting paid. How about you do some free work as well?
Thank you very much.
Hey, Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Hey, Zach, let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Home Stretch, The Gardening Show, coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Subsidium Technologies, providing design, implementation, and management of communications networks, subsidiumtech.com. Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, presenting Junior Jumpstart, a visit and tour day for high school juniors on April 27th, msmc.edu. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com.
Back to Vox Pop. I should let you know that usually on this program, when we have only two guests, we will do announcements at this time. But, you know, we have four today, and it would take up the rest of the show to do announcements. So I would recommend you go to our Vox Pop page. It's wamc.org/VoxPop. And there you will find links to Fadigan's Nursery and Ward's Nursery and the Landis Arboretum. And you'll find out about all the stuff going on in those fine locations. And Patrick Donges is here with us with some more from social media.
Ezra, and I might add that you can also find links to all these fine establishments' Facebook pages on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WAMC Radio.
Yeah, I didn't put that in my script.
Kate on Facebook asks, how do you know whether to plant directly into the ground or to use a raised garden bed for growing vegetables? What are the pros and cons of those methods?
Good question.
Well, you do whatever you want. I mean, you can plant directly into the ground or raised bed. I don't think it matters. You know, there's not necessarily a crop that would do better in one or the other.
There are times, though, speaking from experience, and the only thing I would say is that from our last house where my wife and I lived, I would have always said that. But the soil there was so, they must have taken every bit of topsoil off and had nothing but subsoil. And the soil around there was impossible to get any kind of amending going on to encourage plants to grow.
And that's really essentially what it comes down to is what kind of soil do you have? What is it you're going to be working with? And what kind of space do you want to deal with? Raised beds really offer a easier way to garden. They define the garden a little better. You can work around them. The edge is already there, and you don't have to do a lot of work every year to sort of get them going. So raised beds are definitely easier. But
it's also
either one would work.
Becoming more popular with older folks who can't bend down quite so far.
Yeah, sure.
If you raise them up enough. So it's quality of soil and ease of gardening really is the question.
All right. And what else do you have for us, Patrick?
We've got one more from Liz commenting on WAMC.org/VoxPop asks, you told the prior caller about cutting grape vines to eventually stop their growth. Will this work for poison ivy as well? I have so much poison ivy on my property, and my husband is allergic. I'm trying to get rid of it without using any kinds of poisons.
Okay, that's a great question.
And the answer is certainly yes. That would work very effectively on poison ivy. I would certainly encourage people to take protection when doing this, because even when the poison ivy's not in leaf, the stems and the juices are very much still very active.
And someone who's sensitive to it, if you have it on your clothes, they're going to be exposed to it too. So you may want to consider getting one of these Tyvek hazardous material suits and just wearing that with gloves.
Right, and that'll frighten the neighbors as well. So that would be that's an added bonus.
But it would certainly work by cutting it, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Is that it, Patrick?
That's all.
Splendid job, old boy.
Thanks,
Thank you very much. Let's go back to the phones. It's the Garden Show. Bill at Beacon, you're on.
Hi. I'm trying to reclaim part of my garden for civilization, and there's several ailanthus trees that I want to get rid of, and one of them is like almost 2 inches in diameter. And I'm wondering, do they need to be dug out from the bottom? Or
yeah, I've had good luck the same way, cutting them. Let them grow out in the spring, and then whack them back, cut them. You're taking away their stored energy. And once they use that stored energy in their roots, they use it up to put out new leaves. You cut them. You may have to come back and cut them a couple of times to keep after them. But if you do it at the right time, you're going to wear that plant down. There's no way that plant will beat you.
Great.
Yep.
It may take several cuttings.
We go to Ann in Delmar. Now, Ann, I said we were going to you earlier, and now we're going to you. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
You're on.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is regarding, I have two rhododendrons in a foundation planting raised bed right in front of my house. They're about 5 years old, and I'm noticing some brown coloring around the tips of the leaves. this year, and not a whole lot of buds on them, but that's pretty typical. But I'm wondering about the brown tips.
Yeah, with older rhododendrons, rhododendrons will get some brown in the course of a wintertime. They'll just burn a little bit sometimes. But what will exacerbate that is there's an insect called a black vine weevil, which will eat the roots, and sometimes that will cause more damage. What you're seeing is a desiccation of the leaf. For some reason, that leaf's not getting enough moisture. So the symptom of black vine weevil would be notching, hemispherical notching along the edges of the leaf. And if you see that, that is treatable. Sometimes on older rhododendrons, we see a stem borer. If we get a borer in the trunk of the tree, which interrupts the plumbing, and that can sometimes cause leaf burning too. So it's either just a simple winter burn or an exacerbation of that by some insect, and I would check on the trunk for borer or on the leaf for weevil.
Okay, and how about the fact that it is a raised bed, and I know the moisture has been an issue. So, I mean, could it be that I've been putting a soaker hose on it recently?
You need to make sure it's really well hydrated going into the winter, and you may want to wrap them with burlap in the wintertime and use an antitranspirant, something that's going to cut down on the moisture loss.
Okay. And the second question I have was regarding compost. I'm going to be composting a front garden. It's a perennial garden that gets partial sunlight. I wouldn't say any direct light. I've had it for a number of years, but nothing has – it does well. It doesn't thrive. And I'm looking for a compost. I went to a garden center that has leaf humus, and I'm wondering, would that be a good compost? Would I amend it with anything else? And would I use as much of that as I use mulch in that area, or would it be a smaller amount?
Carrie, you want to take a stab?
Yeah, I mean, leaf humus is good. It's not as nutrient-rich as some of the other organic materials that you can put in. And you also have to know, I don't know what leaves. I know I have large oak trees. Oak leaves are acidic, so you got to, again, it goes back to that pH question to have a healthy plant that can get at the nutrients in the soil. But certainly I would add some, but if I have any doubts, I always like to mix it with something else, like either compost or good age manures, to add in some more of the food value other than just the conditioning value that the leaf humus will do.
Like a mudu or something like that?
Yeah, mudu is good. Good.
Okay.
And
would I use as much of that as I would mulch, or not quite as much?
Well, I think, as we mentioned earlier, is that I think usually somewhere between 20 and 25% ratio of what you're working into your soil. So I always say if you're going down 6-8 inches, then, you know, 25% of that depth, add in organic material and work that in.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
And thanks so much, and good luck. We go over to Eileen. Where are you calling from, Eileen?
I'm calling from Half Moon.
Oh, well, nice to have you aboard. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a river birch that I have planted in my yard. And I put out 5 of them at the same time. And one of them, I believe, has a girdling problem with the root.
Okay.
And I can tell this by the no part of the tree died, but it stunted its growth. And when it did leaf out in the spring, it had the leaves were curled and they turned dark green like the rest of the trees did, but it just didn't grow properly. Well, from what I understand, I believe that the clump birch, the river birch, is a pretty forgiving tree when you attempt to resurrect it. And I want to make sure if I actually try to cut this root at the base of the tree, will it die? Or will the other roots that spread out underneath the ground kind of take over for the tree so that part of it doesn't die?
Yeah, let me ask you this. Do you see the girdling root? Do you see it?
I can see it on the top of the soil on just one portion of the tree, but I can't see that it wraps all the way around.
But you see it partially wrapping.
Yeah, I can see a little bit of it just as it curves along the top of the soil.
Yep, well, then that's a good – so we know what we're dealing with. Because the first step is let's accurately diagnose it. And then two, let's treat it. So first off, how big of a trunk diameter do you think the tree is, just out of curious?
Probably about 7 inches in diameter. All right. I don't hate to cut it down.
No, that's perfect. That's a great size. I consider that a young tree that is even more forgiving. Kids – like young children and babies and stuff like that are very much like young plants. You know, when you're 50, 60 years old, you break a bone, it takes that much longer to heal. Young kids, really quick. Same for trees. Young trees recover very rapidly. So look for the root, and most definitely you want to cut that root. Yeah.
Okay.
I use an old army spoon, to excavate, because I don't like getting in there with sharp items, because when you start digging the soil with anything sharp, you're going to actually start cutting into the trees, bark, trunk, roots, etc. So an old one of those old army soup spoons, any kind of blunt digging item would work well. Probably even an old gardening trowel would probably be weathered enough to work really well. So you go in there and you excavate out and you see the root. And then once you see it, you want to use a saw, get in there, cut that root right away, and that tree will definitely, I would say, would be very likely to recover rapidly. The alternative is if you don't do it, it's pretty much going to guarantee that you'll lose that tree at some point.
Okay.
And I've done this with trees and had amazing results in like 2 to 3 years. It may take a couple of years to see the recovery.
Okay. My other question about the same tree is it has continued to grow. It hasn't grown at the same rate as the other ones that I put in at the same time. And the branches are very dense. Unlike the other birch trees where it's very open and airy, the branches that it has put on are very dense. And I'm wondering how far back can I cut those and at least try to get this tree to have the same appearance as the other ones that it's with.
Yeah. When you prune, you want to prune back to either intersecting branch or node or back to the point of origin, in which case that would be the trunk. And you could very easily, you know, prune and lift the canopy and thin, no problem. I would use probably no more than 1/3 of the foliage off at one shot, sort of a guideline. Okay. So when you do make the cuts, I would wait, you know, till, you know, look at how much stuff you're taking off and look how much stuff is left on the tree, branches and leaves, and, you know, 1/4 to 1/3 of the foliage on the ground would be a maximum. And then with birches, I would also, because they are a bleeder species, so if you pruned them right now, they would bleed like maple trees would, which isn't actually necessarily going to really hurt the tree, but it's not really great for the tree either. So I would recommend pruning those like in the middle of summer, actually, with 1/4 of the foliage as a guideline. So middle of June to middle of July, no later than that, right in that 1 month window.
Eileen, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Janie in New Milford. You're on.
Hey, Ray. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hearing Fred earlier mentioning the stink bugs set me off big time. We have been absolutely. This is a question and a plea to the nursery selling community. We have been inundated all winter long. I've been picking off stink bugs maybe since the first hard frost inside the house that are wintering over, maybe 5-10 a day. Asiatic lady beetles by the thousands this year.
Wow.
I've seen a lot of them, too. So.
And also these little beautiful little black box elder beetles.
Yep.
These are the latest new invasive insect, which I assume must have something to do with climate change. Not the Asiatic beetles. And my question is there anything we can possibly do to discourage them? And the plea is to get the word out to the nursery community to quit selling the Asiatic beetles.
Uh-oh.
They're wiping out the native lady beetles, and they're way overpopulated in our northeast environment now.
Well, I think we should let the nursery people respond now that you've thrown down the gauntlet.
We don't sell them.
I know you don't.
I think we have actually sold them in the past, but I have never heard, though you certainly take a look at that, that they are directly competing with native species. I haven't heard that, but I will look into that.
They are a nuisance getting into the house.
Yeah,
but you said the black ones have been around for a long time.
Oh, the box elder bugs.
They're the latest to arrive on the scene. The black elder beetles.
Well, in your area, we've had them for decades.
Really?
Yeah, they've been around.
South.
Yeah, I would like to say that none of those are actually invasives, though. None of these plants, none of those insects are actually truly invasives, and they actually the Asian ladybird beetle is a really voracious predator of most of the plants.
Aphids
and a lot of other garden pests. So what I do at the Arboretum is, and I follow my own advice here, I vacuum them up with one of those vacuums that has a canister. You can open it up with a push of a button.
Yeah.
And we suck them all up, including those stink bugs, which in a lot of cases what we have is a Western conifer beetle. So they look like a stink bug, but and they smell like a stink bug, but they're actually technically called a Western conifer beetle, the ones that we have.
Uh-huh.
And I just bring them back outside and push the button and let them all go, and they're all alive, and That's not a bad thing to have out in the environment.
Okay. And they're inside your house, Jenny?
But they are a nuisance in
yes,
the house.
Right. So, we live at like a 1745 salt box. And
is
it's
it white?
Like clock with the beetles, the Asiatic beetles. It's like clockwork around Columbus Day. On a warm, sunny day, they'll mass on the side of the house.
Yep. What
and they crawl up under the clabberds, I guess. Yep.
That's right.
Yep, get into the attic. And then
yeah, they're not trying to get into your home. In fact, the actual act of them getting in will desiccate them to the point where they will die if they stay in and don't get out. What they need is cool, and they need moisture. So in your home, dry is not a good thing. So they're getting in by accident, but a vacuum, sucking them up with a canister, bring them out, dump them out. If you don't want them in your yard, possibly go elsewhere.
Okay.
But get them out.
Janie, thanks a lot. And you don't recommend putting them in a blender and chopping
not
them
those,
up?
No, not those. No, because they're beneficials. I would call them, you know, especially the ladybird beetles. Yeah. They're all
right. Yeah, they maybe we can talk more about that on the next show.
They're not good with vodka either.
All right, sir. All right, here's one that Patrick just handed me from social media. Emily, commenting on WAMC.org/VoxPop, asks, my mountaintop garden has been invaded by a variant of Bishop's weed. It's not variegated, it's not bad looking, but it spreads by runners and seeds. It grows only in places where the soil has been disturbed, mostly my garden. What can I do to get rid of it? Weeding makes it multiply. I do my best to deadhead it, whatever that is, but it has taken over, crowding out all my other plants. All right? We have about a minute and a half.
You have to weed it. You have to dig out all of the little white roots that you'll find after you've weeded. Once you've weeded, you just start over. Now, you can actually weed, let it sit for a week or 10 days. New sprouts come. Weed those. They'll come out a lot easier, but you're going to have to weed.
If it's an area where there's nothing else, you can put black poly over it and cook it and just sort of sterilize it with the sun, but there's got to be no other plants desirable in that area.
So garden, you couldn't do that on a garden?
Correct. Not if there's other plants there.
Okay.
No, it is a real tough plant. And that the cutting method that I described for poison ivy, grapevine, and tree of heaven and all the other things, they're woody plants. Bishop's weed's not a woody plant. It's herbaceous, and that will not help that. It'll turn into a nice low-growing bishop weed if
and
you mow it.
As Bob said, if it's really taken over the garden, you may want to remove the plants that you like, minus any little white roots that look like the bishop weed roots.
Yeah.
Replant those somewhere else, and then do the covering because that is another way to deal with it.
Okay. Well, Emily, good luck with that. Let us know. Give us a call next show and let us know how it worked out for you. Let's see. We have another comment on Facebook. Says area farmers markets will have heirloom seedlings. Definitely Troy and Schenectady. And Darlene on Facebook says most land grant university websites have the info. Not sure. Oh, this is on the wood ashes in the garden and the pH.
Yep.
So that puts a wrap on the whole program. Sorry if you did not make it through today. We do try to get to as many calls as we can, but, you know, that's it. There's so many people calling in. You can always hit our WAMC Vox Pop page. It's WAMC.org/VoxPop. Leave a comment. Perhaps the gardeners will take a look and answer some of those questions. You can also do it on Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Support for WAMC comes from Smith College Museum of Art, presenting Collecting Art of Asia, a four-part exhibition celebrating 100 years of Asian art at Smith, from traditional to contemporary, now on view, smith.edu/artmuseum. Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, thedamcafeandeli.com. St. George's School, Clifton Park, New York, a private elementary school offering full-day academic programs to kindergarten and first-grade students, stgeorgeschoolcp.org. And Oblong Books, presenting author Owen King and his new book, Double Feature, Saturday, April 27th, 7 p.m. in Rhinebeck, oblongbooks.com. Well, gardeners, well done. Thanks to Bob and Carrie and, of course, Greg and Fred. And thanks to everybody who called in. Thanks to our producer, the wonderful and organic Zachary Malloy, and Colleen O'Connell answered our phones. Patrick Donjes is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at this time, Moyers and Company. On Medical Monday next week, Dr. Nina Sachs. Stay tuned now for a news update.